In 1874, the British government passed a series of laws called the Regulation of Public Worship. A lot of people cared an awful lot about church back then.
True.
On one side, people wanted more ritual and ceremony.
Order.
On the other side, they wanted mostly none.
Yeah.
In the midst of the battle, one minister, a rector in London at a church called St. George in the East, had stopped a practice whereby people who volunteered in church services could avail themselves of liquor from the rector's cupboard before and after the service. The Reverend King closed the cupboard. We have opened it again. Welcome to the rector's cupboard.
Order!
So every once in a while, and we haven't done this for some time now, we do a hosts only episode. And we just kind of get together and talk about some things, and we have a couple articles here to talk about. Maybe we'll do a little culture moment, check in about some things that Ken has been watching. And so we're pleased here to have Ken Bell here with us, our cupboard master.
It's wonderful to be back.
And Amanda Mina is here.
Hello.
And Allison Williams is here.
Hey, everybody. Hi, Todd.
Thank you. That's fantastic. And we're going to do something. We're going to do something we haven't done for some time, and that's have a tasting.
Hooray!
We are.
Ken's here, and I have to admit,
I took a sip.
Yeah, I didn't.
You cheated?
No, I wasn't even thinking about it.
Cheater,
like, I just
Todd.
Took a sip, and I already like it. So tell us, Cupboard Master Ken, what we're having here.
We are having what is called some ice sounds.
Ambient noise.
A bourbon pecan pie cocktail.
I feel like this is something Keith would really like.
So the three main ingredients, or the only three ingredients in it aside from ice, is vodka and whiskey or bourbon, either one, and a pecan liqueur. And the pecan liqueur
is a strong drink.
Revelstoke pecan liqueur. And
so this is straight alcohol.
This is straight alcohol.
Ooh.
Yes.
Well, no, it's vodka too.
It's a pretty decent size, Ken, as well.
It is. It's okay. one and a half ounces of the pecan liqueur, which is only 21%, so it's a bit light. Half an ounce of vodka, and then 1 ounce of bourbon.
Now Revelstoke, you were at the establishment where.
I was not at the establishment, and
but Revelstoke being Revelstoke, British Columbia. I assume
I. No, yes. It's not, actually. It is
dun,
not.
Dun, dun.
It is from the States.
Okay.
Whoa,
yeah,
are
it's
they
not
allowed
from Revelstoke here. But anyways, it's a lovely liqueur, actually. It's a pecan liqueur. I mean, it tastes like pecan. I mean, it tastes like a pecan pie.
It's a nice Saturday.
With a little kick.
It's a rainy spring Saturday afternoon here.
Just when I would want
a
pecan
lovely,
pie.
Yeah.
Alcoholic pecan.
A little buttery. And
it smells much sweeter than it actually is. Like, it's not a terribly sweet drink. Like, some drinks are almost like cloyingly sweet, but the aroma is very
the nose, if you will.
Yeah, a lot of vanilla, a lot of butter on, and that's coming from
like
the pecan,
brown sugar. Mm.
Yep.
Yeah,
and then the bourbon gives it that deep richness, and the vodka just takes a little bit of the edge off. So anyways, that's our cocktail.
And it's
we will enjoy
quite
this.
A full glass. So this conversation will continue to
it should shape
be more
up.
Entertaining.
Yes, it
yeah.
should shape up.
Thank you so much, Cupboard Master Ken.
Thanks,
you're very
Ken.
Welcome.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Why don't we start our conversation now that we've had this drink introduced to us and we're enjoying it with a bit of a culture check, Rector's Cupboard culture moment. What have we been watching? We're not even primed for this, I don't think. We're not like we didn't come. What have you watched recently? What book have you read recently? What interesting thing have you come across? Let's say in the world of entertainment and pop culture, that could include sports or hobbies or whatever. What kind of things have come across your radar, so to speak? Why don't we start with Cupboard Master Ken, because you've provided us with such a lovely drink.
Well, the two shows my wife and I have been watching, one is an old TV show, Monk. We're just enjoying
it. Tony Shalhoub.
Tony Shalhoub.
I've never watched it.
I heard it's fantastic.
Yeah,
it is. And
it is on what platform here in Canada?
Oh. Netflix.
Netflix.
I only know that because it just popped up as a recommendation for
me
yesterday.
There's like 8 seasons and he's funny and you're not going to change your worldview or grow out of it, but it's just a fun show to watch.
I hear it's good.
Sometimes you need those.
Sometimes you need those.
I might need
there's
to pick that up because
that.
My wife and I gave up on a show called The Americans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it just got
Yeah, much. Some shows go sideways after a few seasons.
So, but Monk, I've heard good things. Yeah. So that's one.
And the other is I have been watching the new Netflix show, Baby Reindeer.
Which isn't about a baby reindeer.
Which
feels a bit misleading.
The title, it's not a Christmas movie.
It's not kids.
It's not about the environment. Yeah.
It's not about like the environment.
Is it about a baby or a reindeer?
Neither of those.
Huh. So, yeah.
And it is, so the opening scene is a guy walks into a police station and says to the police officer, I'm being stalked. And then the rest of it sort of unfolds as the story behind that.
Oh, like retrospective?
It's a bit of a retrospective. Hmm. And my understanding is, and I could be wrong, but my understanding is that not only is this a true story, but the main actor in it is actually the person this happened to.
That is intense.
It's his story.
That's cool.
Which is that.
It's very popular,
correct?
When
you watch the show, it is incredibly intense. And for this person to be willing to put this experience out there and to relive it in pretty vivid detail.
So it's like intense thriller type thing?
Not so much a thriller. Okay. I mean, it is hard. There's stalking and sexuality in it and sexual abuse and assault.
Not something I should watch with my children.
It's called Baby Reindeer.
No babies, no reindeer.
Careful,
yeah.
Everybody.
So, anyways, but it is intense. You have to be ready for it, because it does catch you off guard. Like things are kind of going along, and the actors in it are great. Even this person who I'm guessing doesn't have a lot of acting experience, and then the sort of antagonist in it, or the main antagonist, she's incredible. But it's intense.
And I've read some good reviews on it.
It's a good watch, but you have to be ready for intense.
Hmm. How far into it are you?
Four out of seven, I think we've watched. Okay. Yeah.
1 hour each?
Well, it varies. Yeah, the shortest one is like 20. The shortest one we've had so far is 27 minutes. The longest one is 45.
Okay.
Because it's Netflix.
Have you any cultural kind of...
I've got a couple, but interestingly, they tie in really well to the article that we're going to read.
I was thinking that.
Let's just name them and then we'll go there after.
Yeah, one is Fallout.
Okay. My son Matthew is watching that.
Where is that?
It's on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Admittedly, I only watched one episode and then I noped out, but I did watch it.
Oh.
And then I'm reading a really good book right now, The Ministry for the Future, which is not a churchy book.
Which does sound like we saw that you were carrying around at a ministry/church conference last weekend.
It made me look like I was all in, but it has nothing to do.
Except the word the Ministry for the Future made it sound like maybe a non-believer wrote that because the article shouldn't be there. It's just a ministry for the future. Allison, any cultural?
I've been more nostalgic. It's the very end of my semester. I just turned my last paper in last night.
Which was on the apocalypse?
It was. Awesome. I think we could have an entire different episode about that.
Figure it out?
I did. Yeah. All of it. Definitely. But I've actually been watching old seasons of The West Wing.
Oh, yeah.
Where are
you watching that?
On DVD.
Oh my god.
Oh. Like really old school.
Laser disc. For those listeners who may not know what those are, they're like discs that you put in a machine and then it plays it.
Wow. Whose DVDs are they? Yours?
Mine.
You bought DVD
things? No, they were donated to the garage sale years ago. So I've got the first and second season, and I actually found the next seasons that I'm going to reward myself for finishing my paper at the public library.
So good.
I have appreciated it. It's distressing in some ways what was considered like a potential like administration ending, not conspiracy, like controversy.
In the West Wing.
Because that feels laughable at the moment.
Yeah, it's...
But it is nice. I like it.
But some of the episodes and some of the issues they raise are still amazingly relevant and contemporary.
Oh yeah,
it
holds up.
Impact.
Some of it not all,
not all, but there's lots. I really enjoy it.
Did any of you here happen to watch the final season of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I did not.
No, not yet.
Yeah, you see, that's interesting. That like it was such a kind of cultural phenomenon, right? Yep. And then it's coming to an end, and then, I knew in the first episode. I think I watched all of them now. But I knew because I watched the finale. So I knew in the first episode they were going to do something that was a parallel to how they ended Seinfeld years ago.
Mm. Which was, of course, like classically a downer.
Yeah,
like,
so they were trying to kind of Larry David was trying to kind of redeem that.
And did he?
I think there's the verdicts out on that. I didn't. I really liked Curb Your Enthusiasm a lot of the time, but and I liked the first few episodes of this season, but then I guess it's kind of the point, maybe. Then it just got sick of them.
It's not a show you can binge, to me, anyways.
No.
You can handle
too
like
much.
One, and, maybe two episodes at a time, and then you've got a
concept
walk
of like,
away.
What does it mean to be grown up?
Mm.
Is one that's really interesting. Like how what you can identify with in the show is that like the things that bother people, and you're like, oh my gosh, it's so good that he's saying this.
Yeah, the quiet voice out loud.
Yeah. So you kind of identify with that because we all have that. But after a while, it's a little bit like, it's just intensely obviously self-focused and childish. Mm. Yes, and kind of like, it's okay to try to get past this and to. But I think that's kind of where some of the humor stems, and I think it's probably good they ended it. I think there was some. This is the second time they've had a finale for this show. Because he said, like, after six seasons or eight or four or whatever it was, that was the end.
Mm-hmm. That's a big range.
But this really does seem like the end now. And then the other thing.
It's hard to wrap up a show.
Yeah.
Like,
I think
I think the high watermark for finales to me is Six Feet Under.
I hope Ken says Six Feet Under because.
Yeah.
Now,
should I get that from the library too?
They had a topic that they could do well with that.
Yes. It's about death and a funeral.
But it worked for them.
They found the way to end it. That title actually describes the show.
Much better than Baby Reindeer. Baby Reindeer, very misleading. It's not a Christmas show.
Or that kid show, Murder, Death. And
No. But 6 Feet Under is pretty descriptive.
Six Feet Under, the end was super, super good. Breaking Bad was good. Yeah.
MASH. I'm going to go back a long way.
Oh, man, having our whiskey sour here.
The final episode of MASH.
The Breaking Bad was good, but like many shows, the penultimate episode of Breaking Bad was far and away better than the final.
Well, it was one episode over two.
Yes, kind of. But the whole thing, I mean, it was incredible. Yeah. Just incredible television. That Jen and I have also been watching. You know how you like comfort food shows that you're just like, this is.
I've been watching
because we didn't. Yeah, okay. That kind of, yeah, we watched that years ago.
For us, it's been
Amazing Race, like the current season of Amazing Race. And it just like, we're kind of happy when we have one of those to watch because you'll disconnect and, you know, Jen struggles with Curb Your Enthusiasm because he's such an ass, you know, that. Amazing Race. Although I've noticed a change, we'll get to our articles here. I've noticed a change with Amazing Race. Except there's one couple on this season that they're totally at each other all the time, and the guy is like super condescending to his partner. I think they're married, maybe not, or they're maybe getting married or something. But Jen and I have both noticed that, I don't know, because you know how these shows now have like 40 seasons, but they've been on for 18 years, you know, but
they're
like
37
seasons. So. So I don't know what season it is on this, but we've been watching it since our boys, who are 26 and 24 now, were really, really young, and they loved it.
I mean, I remember watching The Amazing Race when I still lived at home before I got married.
Yeah.
Like and 17 years ago.
Yeah, oh, right? So one of the things we've
noticed... I mean, I got married very young.
One of the things we've noticed is that for the most part, this couple accepted where they're kind of getting the drama from their arguments and they're kind of... for the most part, people are nicer to each other now than they used to be 17 years ago on these shows. I think there is something generationally
interesting
with younger people that it's like you don't do that. You don't treat your partner like that. You know what I mean? I'd
be interested to actually find the first season and watch it and hold it against
in retrospect
another one just to kind of see what you're.
It just used to be so much. Maybe it's strategy because people know you'll do a better job if you're getting along, but that used to be kind of a lot of the show was how people fought. And that's not it now. Now I think that's exceptional.
Like with the puzzles and everything too, right?
Yeah,
like
there's
kind of that like challenge at each thing.
Yeah, I wonder, like we talk about all these things, generational things that are changing. Mm. Like people aren't getting married anymore, or they're certainly not getting married as young as they used to. But in Canada, there's some people who are saying like, oh.
you're like the anti-me for that.
Yeah.
Young people aren't drinking as much. Yeah. And I think... And it's no disrespect to previous generations and older generations, but my kind of, it, obviously it's anecdotal by watching this and stuff, but I think there is a sense of like, we're not going to do that. We're not going to like, kind of pick at each other and
we're get angry be Larry
at each
David.
Other all the time. And, yeah, I guess so, right? That's, yeah, because that's the opposite.
Yeah.
That's the opposite. Like the character, like the Jeff and Susie character on like they're married and yet what the humor is how much they hate each other, right? And how mm-hmm. much they, and yet they're still together in their essence. Well, thank you. That's our culture moment.
Do we need to have some sort of like
there
music
be like
here?
A jingle here.
Jingle. So we have a couple of articles here and we're going to speak about how in our minds they relate to one another. But one is on this term that just keeps coming up and people love using it to talk about groups like ours, like Rector's Cupboard and the other work that we do. And that's the term deconstruction. So one of the articles is on deconstruction and the other article is on basically doom and apocalypse and kind of like the world is coming to an end in a different way. Different ideas of what doom means and the end of time. So we have two people who are going to summarize these articles for us. First, I think Amanda's going to tell us about
I'll keep it succinct, but it's a New York Times article called Climate Doom is Out, Apocalyptic Optimism is In. And the gist of it basically is that we need to hold a more hopeful view for the future. And in doing so, hopefully we'll find people who are more interested in caring. Right? Like,
yeah,
there's so much time that we spend talking about climate and climate change and the inevitable like collapse of our ecosystems and therefore society. And it's all going to be awful. And so instead, let's try framing it in a different way, where there's a hopeful outcome. And it will probably look very, very different than the world that we live in, because the reality is climate change is happening no matter what.
Yes.
But if we approach it a different way, people hopefully will get on board in changing actions and things like that. Yeah. And they talk about even just kind of within culture, there's a shift in the things that people are consuming, the type of media that's being used to portray like apocalyptic things, like they kind of reference the Hunger Games and stuff like that. Is, you know,
dystopia sells.
Dystopia sure does sell. And it really had a moment several years ago among like teen fiction, but then it became kind of pop fiction just around.
Well, they even go back to like world. Mad Max and these things. And we can think.
Well, and Mad Max was
kind of released
recently.
Back to like, can think back to The Day After.
Yeah,
which was about nuclear.
And so like Fallout was just released on Amazon Prime and it's actually based on a video game. So part of the reason that I watch is that my fiance Gavin, it's like right in his wheelhouse.
Has he watched more than one episode?
Oh, he finished all of it.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me.
And it is kitschy and it is over the top, but it kind of pokes fun at the end of the world, and you know, so to speak. In Fallout, like the video game, there's like a nuclear apocalypse. It's not a climate apocalypse, but it's still there, and it, you know, it can be pretty violent. That's where I noped out of it.
Well, and I think another show that has been very popular over the years, it's not called Gilead, Handmaid's Tale.
Yes,
that dystopian view. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a lot of shows that look into the future and say, it's going to be Star Trek may be the one that sort of showed this hopeful view of humanity and the world.
Yeah,
and
Star
stuff
Trek
that,
did.
That it's going to be good.
But otherwise,
going
it's
forward.
Terrible.
But most shows that have captured the imagination in recent years have been, Hunger Games and what's the one with the zombies walking around? Walking Dead.
Walking Dead.
Well, then you have some great
like comedic apocalyptic shows like Good Omens.
Yeah.
So good.
So fun.
Well, or even like you get like the animated like I said, I'm just finishing up a semester with the course on Revelation, so I've been thinking about the apocalypse a lot. But even like Wall-E, talking from like a kid's animation perspective, like that one's based around ecology and
just a different Wall-E. Future very, very much so.
So go ahead.
No keep going,
Ken. You have a different a second article.
Yeah,
so this one on this famous term that people are using to deconstruction, correct? Canadian context.
Yeah, so this comes this is an article we found in on CBC, and it's about a couple who they were together. They broke up because of their faith. They both came from evangelical church backgrounds one of them began to sort of question things. He's a filmmaker. He began to wonder about his faith, wonder about the stuff that was told to him in the church. And she came up, for her, it came up against this line that if you grew up in church circles, especially in the 90s and 2000s, they were unequally yoked.
Oh, we're going to talk about that.
And we'll talk about that. And so they broke up because all of a sudden this one person was doubting their faith, doubting everything. And then they went through a period of being willing to walk through deconstruction. And they encountered some people who, one group has a podcast, I haven't listened to the podcast, but not dissimilar to ours.
They said it was based in London, Ontario.
Based in London, Ontario. And even a former pastor, well, he's still currently a pastor, but an evangelical pastor who also talked about their deconstruction and the hope that came from that of saying, no, you can still hold on to faith and a belief in God, but you don't necessarily have to hold on to the rigidity and the fear that the evangelical faith and that sort of faith tradition used and manipulated, whether it was on the purity culture, which we've talked about a lot of times on this episode, or at least a few times on this podcast,
the damnation stuff
and the damnation stuff, that you can actually have a profound faith in God and Jesus and have a life of faith without also bringing this other baggage on. And they came back together. So they actually did, as I'm remembering the article right now, they did sort of separate, but they've come back together and they have a hopeful view of the future together. And I think my favorite line, we'll get into the story, but my favorite part of the article is actually at the end. They referenced sort of the future, talking about their future child. He could become the most rigid Christian and think we're both going to hell. And he kind of laughs and says, but we would still love him. And so there's this sense of even the future, the person may be completely opposite to me, but yet I find a way to still love them and care for them. And I'm not afraid. I'm not living in that place of fear that the other person has to believe the same thing I do. Mm. And so that's what I got out of this article.
Thanks, Ken. So I want to talk about some of these things, deconstruction, and I to be honest, I'm really struggling with that word now. I don't mean people who are deconstructing and stuff, but it's just come to mean so many different things that at times it doesn't mean.
Which is not anything. Atypical.
Crazy now.
Which is not atypical. Of
questioning is maybe a better. You know what I mean? Like thinking differently about the things you used to believe or think. But Allison, you were you and Amanda and myself were recently at a conference like last weekend at this.
Yeah.
Time. And deconstruction came up. James K.A. Smith, who was the until recently editor-in-chief of Image Journal and a professor at Calvin in the United States, was one of the main speakers. And you really resonated with some of the things that he said about deconstruction.
His entire keynote was absolutely brilliant. Personally for me, I found that so much of what he was talking about really resonated with things that I've been wrestling with in the last year or two, particularly in terms of polarization and how we relate to people who believe so differently than we do. But when he talked about deconstruction, one of the things that he said is, like, he comes from a Christian Reform background, and he said, you know, deconstruction, there's such a spectrum of what that can mean for people. But he's like, when you're talking about from a position of examining your faith as it's practiced, as it's understood, questioning, like, do we really need to believe this, or is this really actually like how we should be understanding God? He's like, we used to have a term for that and we called it reformation. He's like, so for him, he believes that you need
faith
to have
faith has always changed.
It is. And he's like, when I have things that he would probably say that he has reformed his opinion or his theology on, like, he talks about how he's like, I need to have reasons why that is actually faithful to my tradition,
right?
That it's not just, well, culture says this, so therefore I'm now going to put this into my faith. He says, no, like, I need to be able to explain why this is faithful to the tradition that I'm in. So for him, that's CRC.
That's for someone who's choosing to remain in the tradition.
But deconstruction can mean for some people it's more of like a dismantling and a leaving. And personally, I think that that's okay. But there are people who talk about deconstruction and reconstruction. So like it can mean a number of things. I know for myself personally, I think I would describe that I kind of went through a deconstruction, reconstruction sort of faith, yeah. Phase. My faith is very different and continues to be different than what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. Although, like, I've talked about it that I think it would have been easier if I felt I could just leave it and walk away. That felt like that would have been a lot easier. But I didn't feel... Mm-hmm. That conviction, and I don't judge people who do, but that wasn't mine. But I found that, well, and for my husband and myself, I don't think it was a given that we were, as we kind of went on our own kind of journeys of like wrestling with the faith that we were taught or as we understood it, that we were going to end up in a place that was okay with each other.
Right.
We did ultimately, but I don't think that that's...
That's an interesting
a given.
Question. One of the things Jamie Smith also... Like, he has a philosophy background,
yeah,
and a background in terms of like what was called, still is to some degree, but postmodernism. So Foucault and Derrida and other writers.
That, yep.
And this was in, you know, the 1960s and stuff. So when I was studying at Simon Fraser in the late 80s, early 90s, it was already old. Like, deconstruction was was an old term.
As an academic and you term, had, yes.
And so I like that Jamie Smith was like, "If you, I know what deconstruction is." And the,
well, he's like, "I've been publishing on it since 2006.
Yeah, how these terms get kind of simplified co-opted and yeah. some of the meaning becomes... And then there's a whole crowd of people, obviously, who like hear the term, and, oh, those people who are deconstructing, as if like they kind of roll their eyes at it. And but what, you know, whether you call it reform, questioning, whatever it is, that it's an interesting thing. And one of the elements that I've seen, it's to relate to both of these articles, and you mentioned it, Ken, briefly, was the concept of fear and all the things you can be afraid of in these processes. Clearly for this couple, one of them is or was or could have been, what does this mean for us?
Yeah,
we all know people who have had relationships and marriages even end because they came to think differently about faith and found that. Now, for me personally, I find that interesting and curious. I mean, I guess it depends on if you have kids and how you want to raise the kids and all of those kinds of things. But what I'm kind of trying to get at is, where does the fear come from? What are the things we're afraid of? And if you're afraid of someone you're with believing differently than you believe, back, that's how, Ken, you ended your reflection on that article. Is it a threat if your spouse doesn't believe what you believe? Is it a threat if your child doesn't believe what you believe? And classically, of course, for those of us who grew up in the evangelical church, and we've been told it's a huge mm-hmm. threat. So Amanda, I'll get to you in just a sec with it, but that's where this concept unequally yoked comes up, right?
Yeah.
Now you weren't, it wasn't like classic evangelicalism you were raised in, so you probably didn't hear the term as much, unequally yoked.
Or did you?
Well, yeah, because I grew up in more evangelical Anglicanism, right. Which is like evangelical light.
Yeah, but it was you can smoke occasionally.
Yeah. We were allowed to dance and definitely drink.
Anglicans are big on that. They're we will not give that up.
We won't give that up. But that idea of being unequally yoked, and you had to be with people who had the same convictions of you,
it did
come up. And one of the things too that both these articles, I think, and that theme of fear runs through both these articles. And fear is an interesting thing. I was reflecting on it as I was reading these articles, in that fear isn't bad. I mean, fear is the reason we run away from bears and lions. Fear is the reason...
Most of us.
Fear is the reason we don't just walk up to a cliff and go, I wonder if I'll land okay. And even with things like the first article, the one on apocalyptic optimism, and it's talking about the environment, fear can act as a motivator, but it's also temporary. It runs out of steam. It can't sustain itself. And where hope comes in for me is hope becomes that sustaining thing. Because if you just have hope, everything's going to be amazing. Everything's going to be awesome. Everything's going to be beautiful and wonderful. It becomes Pollyanna and you don't become motivated. Sure, but fear can be a place of wisdom and education. Like the article that the first article talks about, that idea that, you know, the environment actually is, like, if we don't do something about climate change, it's going to mess us up.
Well, and it's already happening.
And it's already happening. So the fear plays a role in motivating, but it can't sustain, because otherwise it leads to despair. So right. You have to have both.
But one of the questions I have around that is, and I think this often in terms of, say, my Christian faith and belief, and the people always, you know, wonder with groups like ours, like, do you believe in hell or something, right? And and there are people who'd be like, well, I really like what they're doing, but they just don't believe in hell, which I don't think we've ever made a statement on whether we believe or don't believe in hell. But anyway, it's, but I hold this all the time. And that is, like, if this thing is the best thing in the world, Christian faith say, or whatever else it is, and yet you have this terror at the heart of it, this terror that if you don't believe it, then you're damned forever or something, or eternal conscious torment, you know, even worse or something like that. I've always thought that even if you did believe in that, even if you kind of were like, okay, I think that hell's a, you know, a theological concept that makes sense or something like that. The minute that the fear becomes operational, in other words, where it's like a threat, like if you don't believe this, then you've lost the value of the goodness of the thing itself, right? That this is, and so if people are afraid to give up some of these terrible, terrible concepts, because if we give them up, so unequally yoked, for example, there's one there. Now, the text in the epistles where that comes up, to make that about marriage or a boyfriend and girlfriend or romantic relationship,
I feel like
is a big, big stretch to what the text actually is.
Theological it clearly is gymnastics.
Some kind of maybe business relationship more. Like if you have two people who have some kind of deal and they have completely opposed values, like somebody has, those seem to make sense. But it's come to mean partnership.
It's more about, like, it's more about the power dynamics when people have... when
it's
one
about
person
oxen
has
pulling
has,
the
yeah,
and the
when
yoke
one
being
person
the,
has
yeah.
way more power than the other, be careful about how that relationship lives out, because it's ultimately going to lead to some sort of abuse or dehumanizing right. of the other.
Well,
that's
but of course
what it's
the fear piece for us, and Amanda, you would have known this growing up in an evangelical youth group, the fear piece around if you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend that like is. Then that's really gonna be a problem, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Because if you're not both believers, and if you're not, so you have to believe the same thing, and so the questions would be like, what would it mean to give up that fear? You have it in terms of this article, you have it in, but you were gonna mention from
well, there. I think the article names it really well. Like, we're talking about kind of high concepts of hell and stuff like that, but there's more tangible things that he talked about, like. One of the people in the article just said that it was a very lonely experience because losing one's belief system also means losing one's community.
Yep.
Which is something we've talked about in other episodes at length. And like, that's a very real immediate thing. Not even just the, you know, eventually I'm going to end up in, yeah, eventually I'm going to hell because I believe this thing. But in the immediacy of it, you could lose all of your friendships or the relationship that you've entered into.
Yeah,
and that's a real thing.
Like,
and like, I can resonate
like that.
With that. Like, we've talked again, like my relationship with Gavin. Gavin doesn't believe the same thing I believe.
Right.
And early in our relationship, I didn't even tell you guys about him, which, you know, it sounds crazy now, but it was
no,
a real
thing. No, but
the
fear's real of what is, because I've known people who, yeah. because of relationships that they were in or because of beliefs that either they professed or ones that they refused to mm-hmm. confess. Like, they weren't even necessarily saying, I believe something different, but they're just like, I can't say this. I've seen people get kicked out of communities.
Yeah.
I've watched
yeah.
it
so
happen.
That real fear of just the loss of friendship and relationship and things like that are, like, it's very real. Mm-hmm. I understand.
Which is at play in the article, Ken, that you brought up from CBC, that how, you know, the idea that these two separated because they felt they were she felt they were unequally yoked is something that wouldn't necessarily have entered her mind in that way, at least, without that evangelical.
There's a
upbringing,
line in here
right?
that just it hurt me a little, where he said, for so long I believed I wasn't good enough for Christianity and that my desire to do film was incompatible with my faith. Mm. And I think where it hurt was just this, like, coming from a community that made you feel that way in the first place just you know.
Yeah.
One of the things I like in this article, there's almost like a wonderful naivete at the beginning with them, where they're both growing up evangelical and they have these, I guess you'd call
them. I want to be a missionary and be married to a pastor. Yeah.
Well, like, no. Wanting so to be clearly, a missionary is one thing. Like, that's bad enough. But having a dream of being married to a pastor.
You can, like, if any of you ever meet my wife, you can ask her what that's like.
Jen had a nightmare of that. We had to talk through that. She was like, everything else is good, but I don't know that I want this. And then it was interesting too how at the end of that they do have a pastor,
yeah, who
says
pastor.
That he's kind of gone through some deconstruction of his own, but then he says something that's very much endowed with faith, right? He says, often we move from wrestling with God to walking with God. God is bigger than our deconstruction. So that doesn't have to be the end of your journey with God. This is invitational, not coercive. We've talked about coercion here, how it works. And I think that's what I'm feeling with some of this stuff, is that ways that in which we have beliefs, so whether it's reform or deconstruction, or if we again think back hundreds and hundreds of years ago to when they used to burn heretics at the stake because they believed in things like you should be able to read the Bible, you know, or... You know, that whatever it might be, things that the evangelical church now just takes for granted.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But those were the heretics. And faith and belief changed from a even more fear dominated kind of way. And so I have this hope right now that many of these elements of fear, the ways that terms like unequally yoked have been used, the way that people are afraid of differentiation of their children. Like your child grows up, they're in their 20s, and they don't believe what you believe. And the fact that in your faith, that your faith could motivate you to say,
it's okay.
Yeah, not only is it okay, but yeah. I mean, you're not necessarily going to say this, but thanks be to God in a sense, right? This is, my faith is big enough for this. And I'm not even saying that and if I do that, one day you'll come to believe, right?
No, it's a faith without a goal of conversion at the end.
Yeah, and of course, these methods of how unequally yoked and such were used are methods of insular cult things.
I actually had someone say to me recently, it's good that you and Gavin have different beliefs, but one day he'll come around.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling terribly, I'd be skeptical about that.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
It's great. Actually,
there's also this might sound a bit idealistic, or I also I think belief gets a bit too much press. What I mean is,
yeah,
I thought we thought that something was true. And so if you have confidence, let's say you are a Christian and more in the evangelical frame, and you believe these things about God, and you think the universe has come about in this way, and you have some kind of vision of the end and, you know, Jesus and his return and all of these things, then accepting the fact that you believe in some kind of fearful damnation and separation, right? So I understand that. But in general, if something is true, then it's true whether you believe it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gravity exists whether I believe it or not.
So if you believe in God's goodness ultimately,
the earth
and that
is
the
still
future,
round.
Yeah, if you Indeed. Believe in God's goodness and that the future is headed somewhere positive.
Mm-hmm.
Then the air gets taken out of, like, it's, you know, you wind up, it's okay if they don't believe like I do, but the reason I can feel that is actually because of my faith, right? That this is something
And I think it's something like, I hope that we can get a recording of Jamie Smith's lecture from last week, because we should talk about that. We should post it. You should listen to it.
Yeah.
But he talked about just this embrace of mystery. And one of the correctives that he gave is, he's like, evangelicals have a long tradition of embracing mystery. He's like, you go back to Calvin, you go back to Luther. They didn't reject, the Reformation did not reject mystery. He's like, that really came around in, the revivals of the 1800s.
Yeah, recently.
And so he's like, mystery and understanding that there are unknowable things that you cannot articulate, things that you cannot comprehend, things that are bigger than human understanding. He's like, that is very orthodox and has been for most of the church's history. And embracing the limitations of our knowledge, I think, is a really mature step in faith. And not to just say, not in a way that, I am finishing up a master's degree in theology. I have a decent amount of education in theology. And I feel confident of significantly less things than I did when I started. And I don't view that as a negative thing. I think it is positive.
The most confident is before
you start. How little you know.
Well, like I have just become aware of it is so much bigger. It is so much more expansive. It is so much more good than I believed it was. And so I see that as a beautiful and mature kind of step in my faith, is embracing the very real limitations of, you know, not just the human capacity to know, but my own capacity to know. Like, I am finite.
Yeah.
I don't feel that's a threat.
Jamie had said about, like, we just need to let go of this, like, deep need for knowing, right?
Yeah. As a philosopher.
I know. I loved that. It was beautiful. And it really, it's just like our Western culture, especially, like, we have to understand all
things.
We're
obsessed.
And
and know all the things and carry it in our pockets with Wikipedia and our phones and all of the things, and just, like, let go of, like, trying so hard to understand.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this concept on the podcast before in different ways, but that the enemy of the antithesis of faith, the enemy of faith is it's not doubt, it's certainty and absoluteness. And that's where we get into trouble, is certainty and I know this to be true absolutely without any doubt.
Like, and that's when you take a stance.
And that's when you take a stance.
And that's when you think, if your child or someone else doesn't believe this, then it's the worst possibility in the world.
And I think fear plays a big role in that. I think one of the things I liked about this other article about, it was more about the New York Times one, about the environment. It's right near the beginning of the article. It talks about there's room for screaming and there's room for dreaming.
Yeah,
because if you're only screaming, the world's coming to an end. Mm-hmm. Like I was just with some extended family members back east, and they were sharing how, you know, them and I think a lot of other people I know don't want to bring children into this world because they have such a dystopian view, and they're certain that the world is going to be horrible. They're certain of it, and that kind of saddened me. But if you just have this unattached dreaming of everything's going to work out, and so it does require both. And I think even within our faith, there is a role for that motivation of uncertainty that comes from fear, because it does it offers an element of destabilization. And destabilization is the best way, or one of the best ways, to work against certainty. We were all convinced of this thing, and then something comes in and destabilizes us, and now we no longer believe that, and we have to now believe in something different and something better, even if it's scary. And so that's one of the reasons why I like this article.
Different wrestles. Concept of fear, though, than what I grew up with.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's a horrible
There's nuance in that.
Fear is fear. Yeah, absolutely. But I don't want to lose fear.
Yeah, we need to redefine.
Right. Just like we redefine whether it's reformation or deconstruction. I've talked about on the podcast before. I prefer the concept of renovation. I enjoy that concept even more now, because I think, you know, sometimes you there's a church in Vancouver I just read about that's up for sale. It's a Presbyterian church, $10 million.
What a steal!
It is
bargain.
And does it come with any Presbyterians? Or?
No, it's Presbyterian free. That's why they're closing it. But it can be the idea that it can be renovated into. You can keep it as a church. You can keep it as a heritage. You can turn it into condos. You can turn it into a business. It can be renovated, and as much of the original you can keep as you want. But it's okay to peel back as many layers. Find the rot. Find the things that aren't helpful. Find the things that are really destructive. Move the walls around, and that's actually okay. So you don't have to throw everything out just because you're renovating.
So then with that, I want to move to, and trying to look forward with this, one of the terms that resonated with me in the article, it's not actually written in the article itself, it's a heading, but there is a section building from that heading, and that is the words that says, imagining a better future. That becomes a bit of a thoughtful critique of some of these ways of, like you were mentioning when we were talking about television shows and such and movies, that the apocalyptic ones, even just the word apocalyptic carries a very negative connotation, right? And the concept of imagining a better future is something that is not maybe as prevalent as it should be. Not being blind to the challenges of the present and the immediate future. But so I would
but
ask...
But there is a shift culturally. Like, that's kind of what it's talking about.
Yeah,
like
but I
idea
think...
that. Like the last line of that New York Times article kind of stuck with me. In order to build a better world, you need to be able to envision that one is possible.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And that's what, okay, wonderful. Because that's what I'm saying is, or what I'm thinking and hoping, that certain understanding of Christian faith could bring with them is we do need people who can hope for better things and can imagine
and
a better future.
That's possible.
And if people are having trouble imagining a better future, including fellow Christians, then it would be people like us and others who are like, wait, we have a positive view of the future. I will try and get him on sometime. I haven't actually reached out to him, but Philip Ziegler, Phil Ziegler is a professor at the University of Aberdeen. He's a Canadian writer. He has a book out. This is a 5 years old now or more, called Militant Grace, The Apocalyptic Turn and the Future of Christian Theology. And the basis, the fundamental argument of this book is that apocalypse is a positive and hopeful term. Mm. So he says things like if when we, and he says like we need to re-Christianize views of the apocalypse. He says it's not retributive. It's not apocalypse unto retaliation. It's unto grace. It's unto life.
And
it's
unto,
unto
reconciliation
love. It's
and
unto
restoration.
Renewal
and,
and so, but even if you even introduce that as an idea, people are like, well, apocalypse is negative because of popular culture, but mostly popular culture gets there because of understandings of faith. So whether it's from the deconstruction article or the climate article, what is it that you think people are afraid of if we let go of fear in that way, not the way Ken's talking about, but so you could go to relationships. What would happen if we say, it's okay if your partner or your child doesn't believe what you believe? What do people think we will lose? The faith?
I think
then nobody
people,
would believe if you don't kind of tell your kids to get your kids to believe?
I do think that for some people, yeah, that would be
then Christianity will
their
die.
Motivation.
Your soul?
Your soul. Yeah, maybe.
Eternal
I mean,
damnation
or
is a pretty decent motivator.
The thing that you believe, maybe it isn't
true, real.
Yeah, right?
If which is kind of telling about that fear, right? Mm-hmm. Like that has more to do... and
it has more to do with them.
Sure, and if you think about... Yeah, I'm not even ascribing negative motivation to them.
No.
Like they could be wanting the best for... Mm-hmm. But if you... Yeah, if that is going to kill the thing...
Well, the image I've used in the past, I think we've talked about it too, is the it's like a house of cards or whatever image you want to use. But as soon as you pull one piece out, everything else falls. And then who am I? What do I believe? What can I trust? What is stable?
Yeah.
And so the fear is if I change this one thing, the rest of it falls apart. Mm. And I think that that becomes like if I'm willing to admit that being unequally yoked is actually okay
in that old way of the understanding
in that then does that mean everything else I believe to this point, my whole understanding of the world, my whole understanding of myself, my faith, my relationship with others, my does the rest of it all now to be need to either
so
completely
to
come
some
crumbling
degree,
or do I need to question
well,
it
to some
all.
Degree you're admitting that it's pretty thin then.
Well, it,
absolutely.
And it's very binary. It's either an all or it's a nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think we can have more nuanced views of things.
You could go, let's go one further because we can. It's more, it's like a devotional question. Does God care what you believe? If you have a faith in God, like is what you believe ultimately the thing that matters most?
Mm. How much of a heretic would you like me to be at the moment?
How much of
and
your
I'm saying this as someone
consumed?
Who has Christian faith, right?
Maybe
I just don't think my Christian belief is the end all
I
and
mean,
be all.
Well,
I think
I think so. Yes, I believe that. I'm trying to think how I could summarize this. I think that salvation, that eschatology, like the end of all things, the end of the age, heaven, afterlife, whatever you may term it, I think that that has much more to do with God than it does with me. And so when I look at, I don't believe that I am the agent in that scenario. I think God is. And so I don't know. I mean, I've been accused of being a universalist and I've been called much worse.
You have.
I have. personally, I kind of take Will Willimon's approach where he's like, you should want that. Like, I believe that Christ's death, resurrection, that salvific act was so powerful that when the creator of the universe inhabited human form and, you know, came down to earth and dwelled amongst creation, that redeeming act was so powerful that all things can be saved.
Well, and
that's what I believe.
Well, and that something actually happened.
Yes.
That it wasn't. And I think it has
more to do,
like,
with God than with me.
This took place, but it doesn't change anything unless you assent to believing in it. I'm not saying what you believe doesn't matter. I think concepts like human rights, how you think of other people, how you see others' value,
are those issues of salvation? Dignity, how,
like, what you believe and think, your worldview will like lead in those ways. I'm just the idea that and this is reform, right? That Martin Luther and the way he and others changed concepts of what it means, you know, by faith, right? You're saved. That so then you get to the evangelical church where that's what it's all about now, is belief, not acts, right? You not purchasing salvation and the rest. But what's the next thing? What's the next kind of, like, we have stressed so much that you damn well better believe this. Not that we're going to put it that way, but, and so now you have parents who are literally in some churches, they're coming apart because they're like, one of the things that this CBC article says, it just briefly mentioned, like, the CBC is not a religious broadcaster by any means. And they have a couple of things in there. One, what that pastor said, and another where they talk about, like, a couple things that are quite positive in terms of how they're talking about faith and what's happening. But one of them is actually, like, many young people who have grown up in faith circles or evangelical circles are questioning these things, but they do it in such a nice and responsible way, right? But you have in some places parents who are just in fear, almost a terror. Sometimes it's just like how it will look like in the eyes of the church if their kids don't believe, but others it's actually an existential, like
I can have sympathy for that, certainly. I mean, I grew up in it, I believed it, like, those were the waters I swam in for formative years of my life, and so I can have sympathy for it. But if we go back to Apocalypse, like, talking about, I mean, the root of the word is, like, it is an unveiling. Mm-hmm. It is like, it's like the scales have been pulled off of our eyes, that we have actually been able to see things as they actually are.
Removing the lid from the pot.
Yeah, you can
no
see
longer
see
through
it.
The glass darkly.
Like, yeah. It's, you, it's one of those things. But it, I mean, I certainly know why people struggle with the book of Revelation and why there are things in there that are concerning. But when you actually look at it, like, I largely view it as very positive. And one of the things that it can do, though, is it can be very challenging because it challenges where we think power lies, where we think, like, the power for, like, yeah, how we structure our lives. And it shows us that it is not here that power lies, but it is in God. And one of the things that, in one of the readings I did for my paper, that I just loved this term, where they were like, is everything hopeless? Are we all just, like, stuck within, for this author, they're talking about, like, imperial systems and stuff like that. Are we just doomed? And they're like, well, in some ways, but it's even helpful when we can have an awareness of it. And I think that that's a positive way that we can look at environmental apocalypse, like apocalypticism, or even faith,
like religious
apocalypticism, is if we can understand an awareness of it. And they end with, like, at least we can open a few more of our own eyes, which I just, like, thought that was a great line, talking about the many-eyed.
Revelation is a lot more helpful when you realize that the island John was stuck on is a place where certain psychedelic mushrooms flourish.
I just always, I mean, we've talked
about it. I'm not saying he was on mushrooms. I'm just saying psychedelic.
Something's happened there.
But in answer to your question, do we think that God, what was the question? Do we think that God cares what we believe?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do. But that's because...
Is that impactful of what will happen?
Well, no, but it's out
of... But if you believe the wrong thing, you're damned?
No, but it's out of relationship.
Yes.
The same way a parent, of course, cares about what their child thinks. Mm. Of course, because if you think these horrible, awful things about me, well, that's going to impact our relationship.
Mm, I like that.
And so I think to that degree, does he care? Yes, God cares. Is it going to change God? Is God going to change God's mind? Is God going to change the way our the universe outcomes, runs?
Yeah.
Absolutely not, but cares because of love, because of relationship.
I feel for parents of a certain generation too, where there's this fear of, what do my kids believe? Is it all coming apart? Because there's also kind of a cultural, at least in the Western context, we can use a cultural coming apart where we're afraid of the climate. We're afraid of...
That's why I bring these articles together.
And housing, like our kids can't own a house. And it was a guarantee that, I was going to own a house. And as long as I did these five things in my career, then I was going to have these things. And none of those are going to be available to kids necessarily, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a given.
Not wholly, but that's kind of the world that they're... living in. And so there's this feeling, if you go with the house of cards or whatever, it's not just a faith house of cards, it's just
it's
that
a whole
cultural, the structure that I understood to be true is not true anymore. And so here's just one more thing,
and it's very
that
disorienting.
They're not holding. Yeah
That's well put. So well, I'll end with a little it's from the introduction of Ziegler's book, Militant Grace. And as I say, his overall argument is the need to re-Christianize or Christianize concepts of the apocalypse as something positive and hopeful, not fearful and terrifying and death dealing. In the introduction, one of the things he says that this should be happening in Christian theology. And I think to some degree it is. And he says, as that happens, indeed, a range of Christian doctrines, those concerning sin, grace. So just think of how this relates to people's actual lives, right? To like the CBC article. Doctrines on sin, grace, salvation, the character of the Christian life, invite reconsideration in light of an understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ as the announcement of God's eschatological turning of the old passing age. So in other words, we will think about sin, grace, salvation, and the character of the Christian life differently when we drop some of that fear. And that is not un-Christian. Not saying that any of our listeners have to be Christian, but for those who are listening or in those places of struggling, like if I give up this fear,
am I still being faithful? Yes.
In fact, Ziegler and other, Christian theologians, pastors, writers, and people like us are saying, not only is it not un-Christian, it's something that the Christian church needs. And so bless you in that work, and thank you guys very much. Thanks, Ken, for the drink. It was
good
lovely.
Drink.
You're
I think I have to finish Allison's now for her
because
there's
a
lot of
it was a little
that
big.
Left. Yeah.
I'm happy to finish.
Thanks, everyone.
Perhaps mine too.
Blessings.
Bye.
Rector's Cupboard is a production of Reflector Project and is hosted and produced by Todd Weeb, Allison Williams, and Amanda Mina. Our cupboard master is Ken Bell. Rector's Cupboard is made possible by the generous support of donors. Check out rectorscupboard.ca for past episodes, events, and how you can help fund the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, which helps other people find us. Thanks for listening.